supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
A controversial natural gas pipeline now has the go-ahead from New Jersey officials. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The project will go up in part of the Pinelands, a protected nature reserve in South Jersey, and that's drawn harsh opposition from environmentalists, activists, and residents. WHYY's Joe Hernandez was on hand at today's meeting where the pipeline was approved and offers this report.
This was a regular meeting of the Pinelands Commission, but there was nothing regular about it. Busloads of opponents, as well as some pipeline supporters, made up the crowd of more than 500 people. And it wouldn't have been a protest without protest songs. Just as the 15 commissioners were getting ready to vote on the pipeline, opponents launched into a time-honored Woody Guthrie tune. The pipeline was approved. It will send natural gas 22 miles across South Jersey to a power plant on the Jersey Shore that's transitioning off coal. Critics claim the pipeline is unnecessary and will harm the Pinelands, what one person called New Jersey's Yellowstone. Matthew Downing of Marlton says the project sets a bad precedent.
I agree. It's going to open the door for more and more projects like this to go through the Pinelands. And the more you cut it up, the more wildlife is disrupted, the more chance of water being destroyed, fires, etc. It's bad, bad news.
What's bad news to some is good news to others. Dave Hines is a union worker from South Jersey who was wearing a sticker saying he supports the pipeline. I asked him why.
Why I support it? Because it means jobs for us. And it's because we need energy. They're closing down a nuclear plant. We need energy.
South Jersey Gas, the company building the pipeline, says it will provide a backup fuel source for residents and mean that less coal is burned. The company says it's pleased with the vote but has not specified when it will start construction. Some opponents say they're planning to challenge the decision in court in the meantime. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
A special election in Delaware tomorrow is drawing national attention and big bucks. WHYY's Mark Eichmann has more on the vote that could give Republicans control of the Delaware Senate for the first time in decades.
There are 35,000 registered voters in Delaware's 10th Senate District, about 16,000 Democrats, 10,000 Republicans, and about 9,000 not affiliated with the major parties. Those residents live in the booming southern Newcastle County area of Middletown and parts of Glasgow. Those voters will have the chance Saturday to give Republicans control of the state Senate for the first time in more than 40 years. This Senate seat became vacant when Bethany Hall Long took office as lieutenant governor in January. In addition to raising hundreds of thousands of dollars to support Democratic candidate Stephanie Hansen, former Vice President Joe Biden has knocked on doors in the district with Hansen and recorded TV ads touting her campaign.
Stephanie Hansen understands what people need. This election is very, very important. Don't ask yourself the morning after the election, why didn't I vote?
Republicans like State Senator Greg Lavelle are salivating at the chance to take control of the upper chamber for the first time in decades. Lavelle sees the use of heavy hitters from the Democratic side as a symptom of what he calls one-party rule.
The fact that they're bringing in everyone who's currently in control fits perfectly because these are the people who have bought us these problems. We believe that balance in government is good and will result in better compromises, more substantive compromises, and deal with these issues.
Democratic candidate Hansen says her party has held the majority in both chambers of the Delaware General Assembly for so long for a reason.
Delaware has been a very Democratic state since then, I think because the Democrats have really kind of spoken to the issues that were important to the people.
The Republican candidate, John Marino, declined WHYY's request for an interview to talk about the race, but blamed the Dems in control for the state's financial woes earlier this month at a candidate forum in Middletown.
Delaware has been one-party rule in the Senate for 44 years. It has led us to where we are today in a $350 million budget deficit with $220 million of tax increases on the way, with jobs leaving the state, with our public education system underperforming because of overregulations. Delaware, this race is critical.
Voters like Middletown's Jim Reynolds have been weighing the candidates ahead of Saturday's election.
It's very important with this, for this area. We've had great representation for years with the senators and the representatives of this area. They've worked well with the town, and it's real important that we get someone elected there that will work with the town and the local communities around it.
Bethany Hall Long was re-elected to this seat in 2014 by defeating John Marino. She won by fewer than 300 votes. Marino's back again, hoping to secure a GOP majority in the state Senate with a better outcome this time around. And with national and local supporters focusing so much attention on the only race in Delaware on Saturday, Senator Lavelle says voters in the district have been inundated with ads, mailers, and visitors knocking on their doors.
I'm sure everyone in the 10th Senate District will be happy when Saturday night at 8 p.m. comes and they're not harassed any longer by either party.
From the Delaware Desk, I'm Mark Eichmann, WHYY News.
Do Americans prioritize being number one in the world in the realm of money or military might? Answers from Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
How should we get at this, Frank?
Well, let me ask you, Dave, economically or militarily, what is most important to the average American in terms of the U.S. position in the world? What would you say?
Well, let's see. In our time together, Frank, the economy is typically near or at the top of mind concern. I guess that's my answer.
Well, you're wrong.
What?
Americans, yeah, by over 20 percentage points say that it's more important that the U.S. be number one militarily. Two-thirds of Americans say it is important that the country is number one militarily, and slightly less than half, just 46%, say it's important that the U.S. is number one economically.
Do Americans aspire to be number one militarily, or do they believe that we are?
Well, I guess that's the good news. There is a consonance between what they believe is the case and what they want to be the case, because, yes, over half of Americans say at this point in time the U.S. is the number one power militarily in the world. Only one out of five of Americans say that the U.S. is number one in the world economically.
And are they doubling down, saying that we should spend more on the military?
No, there isn't a direct correlation there. Americans are still split. We say, are we spending too much, too little, or about right on the military? And crudely speaking, it's about a third, a third, a third. So we don't have a large percent of Americans who at this point say we're spending too little on the military.
So as an aggregate, most people then would say it's about right or too much.
Absolutely. If you put those two together, you've got a majority of Americans who say in terms of military spending, defense spending at this point, we're either spending too much or about the right amount.
Let's come back home and turn to attitudes around President Donald Trump this week.
I would say he's been averaging right around 42% overall. 90% of Democrats disapprove. But, you know, Dave, this is interesting. I went back and looked when Barack Obama had 42% approval rating, which he did at a number of points in his term. He had 90% of Republicans who disapproved of the job he was doing. And then I went back further to when George W. Bush had 42% approval rating. And just like Trump, we had 90% of Democrats who disapproved of George W. Bush.
Frank, polarization certainly at play, but were any of the previously named presidents or any that come to mind this low in the polls this early in their term?
Absolutely not. Donald Trump's ratings plummeted faster than any president that we have records for after first being inaugurated, and that goes back to Dwight Eisenhower.
Does the pattern point to the possibility of him emerging from that trough?
So if Trump's approval rating is going to go up, he's already getting 80-90% of approval from Republicans. He's going to have to move some of those kind of swing voters, if we want to call them that, swing Americans in the middle, the independents. It's very unlikely that Trump's going to be able to move many Democrats from the disapprove into the approve column, at least based on our look at history.
If I'm hearing you right, it's likely that a theoretical President Hillary Clinton would have had that same gulf in terms of partisan support.
Yes, we'll never know, of course, but she had almost as low favorable ratings when she was campaigning prior to the election in November as Donald Trump. So my assumption as an analyst is that were she now president, she would be getting, like Obama, extremely low approval ratings from Republicans, and she would probably be in a similar boat. She would not have had a honeymoon period. She would have a relatively low approval rating at this time.
And, of course, the intrigue is whether these were and are particularly polarizing people, or if more centrist candidates might have had a honeymoon of sorts?
That's an excellent question. There are two factors at work here, and that's very, very important that you highlight that, Dave. One is we're in a more polarized environment based on everything we know. So no matter who the president is, they're going to have a hard time getting any kind of approbation from people from the opposing party. But overlay on that the very reaction-generating negative persona of Donald Trump, the president, as all of our data have shown, and you put the two together, and you've got this situation where Republicans like him, Democrats don't, in these hugely different numbers.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. Applications for medical marijuana grower, processors, and dispensaries in Pennsylvania are being accepted until March 20th. Now, to date, some 900 applicants are vying for up to 12 permits issued for grower processors across the state's six medical marijuana regions. Entering the fray in our area, businesswoman Lindy Snyder. Lindy, welcome to Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you.
This isn't only a business concern. It's personal as well. Your parents passed recently of cancer. Your mom, Myrna.
That's right.
Did she avail herself of medical marijuana toward the end?
She did. And then, of course, my father as well.
Your father is Ed Snyder, the former chairman of Comcast Spectacorp, owner of the Flyers. He, too, passed of cancer. Did he also turn to medical marijuana?
He did. And at the time, toward the end of his life, he was in California, where medical marijuana is legal. And it was suggested even by the hospice nurses that he should try it because it is used more widely in California for exactly this purpose, for hospice, for end-of-life care, well, for pain management as well as other conditions.
Though Pennsylvania's program, as I understand it, offers the widest range of qualifying recipients of any state.
That's right. We have more qualifying conditions out of the gate than other states have had, which is very valuable.
You're eyeing a site, 125,000 square feet, I understand, in Northeast Philadelphia. How did you choose that area?
First, of course, we had to go to the community, and we found that the community there was very welcoming and they were very open. And I think that's the most important thing you have to consider first is the partnership that you're going to have in any given community. You're always going to have people that have concerns that are still looking at it as a drug or a gateway drug. But I think as time has marched forward and the press is really doing a great job of covering this, you're starting to see people have a change of heart and a change of mind about how they view this. And so, for example, going into the community, talking about these issues affects great change in people's attitudes. Even people who were naysayers a month ago may have had a change of heart. All of a sudden, they're hearing their neighbors talk about how their loved one was suffering through pain and used medical cannabis and how it helped.
It's a different kind of business, though, because still at the federal level, cannabis remains a prohibited substance. And with that, there are all sorts of banking problems. How do you hope to circumvent that and not merely have this as a cash business?
Well, there are some predicates for that. You're seeing states around the country where banking is happening, usually with smaller, more local banks, but the banks are starting to really become comfortable about accepting bank accounts around this industry as the industry continues to evolve.
I imagine there is some sentiment, at least in the public, that this is a get-rich-quick endeavor.
Not by any stretch. And the history and the truth about this business is it's capital intensive. It takes a great amount of time. It's a lot of high risk. There's the same business principles and practices that have to be applied to this industry as any other.
Think Snyder. You think business, of course. Was it a sell, a hard sell to get family members and other business colleagues and affiliates on board?
Yes and no. There were some family members or friends that thought it might be risky. And then one of the delightful things about this industry is you see these incredible partnerships between these really young entrepreneurial millennials with people that are older, more experienced, that bring their experience to the table.
If you're fortunate enough to be awarded a license and the timetable is somewhat accurate, I'm looking forward to having you back in a year or so to see how it's playing out at that point.
Thank you. I'd love to come back.
And you can hear more of my conversation with Lindy Snyder at newsworks.org. A coalition called Take Action Philly is rallying the city's legal community to combat the Trump administration's agenda on immigration and refugees. WHYY's Katie Culinary reports that more than 200 people turned out for the first meeting this afternoon.
Among the speakers addressing the crowd was Joey Asali, an Allentown resident whose Syrian family members were barred from entering the country when they first arrived in the U.S. last month.
Even while we were still waiting on the status of my family, the unconditional support of our team of attorneys gave us hope that even if we could not bring them back right away, we would never stop fighting until justice prevailed.
This was the theme of Take Action Philly's first meeting, that the so-called resistance movement to the Trump administration's agenda will rely heavily on lawyers. Miriam Enriquez heads up Philadelphia's Office of Immigrant Affairs. Enriquez says since the election, she's been flooded with calls from attorneys.
A lot of the nonprofits got together and they invited both my office, the Office of Immigrant Affairs, and the law department to really start meeting and coming up with how can we get all the lawyers together, the legal community together, educate them on the issues, but then also give them a way to help.
Enriquez says the coalition plans a series of free legal clinics this spring where immigrants can take steps to become citizens and refugees can get help with applying for green cards. As for non-lawyers, the coalition is encouraging them to help out these efforts with their wallets. Katie Culinary, WHYY News.
The new administration has given Americans plenty to talk about around immigration. The new WHYY podcast, Common Space, a collaboration with First Person Arts, captures those conversations as they play out in art, music, and poetry. And while the immigrant experience has taken center stage, the experiences of their children, first-generation Americans, have long provided grist for art. In this excerpt of a recent episode, producer Elizabeth Perez Luna talks with host Jamie Jay about the art of first-generation Americans.
The sons and daughters of immigrants often get involved in social justice issues because it's everyday issues. So they sing and protest in solidarity with other immigrants and workers like their parents and siblings.
And they're acutely aware of the trials and tribulations of American immigrant history.
Which is quite complex,
yeah. That's right. It reminds me of this, of the song that we used for the episode of the South Asian group Carmacy.
From the West Coast, yeah.
March 1st, 1977, that's when I dropped on the scene. 4 years prior to my sister Charlene, just like a dream baby, I was born in mama's hands. Bombay to USA, immigrating from the motherland, the son of a government gynecologist. You don't even know the politics of how the dollar twists. Traveled down to Mississippi, all the way to Hawaii, then back over to California where my soul forever lies. So I grab the mic and premedically meditate, and as you segregate, I contemplate the meaning of my race. You delineate a road for me to take, a path for me to follow. Yes, I know it's crazy hard for you to swallow the truth, because it hurts that I'm coming up first. South Asian from my birth, living life on this beautiful earth. What you see is what you get, but do you get what you see? I'm on a quest for the real reality.
Carmacy really calls out this idea of how we sometimes look at immigrants as they, the other. And we forget that, you know, just because you may have a different language or an accent, you know, that identifies you as being connected to someplace else, it doesn't mean that you don't have the same hopes and dreams for your life.
Yeah, and for the younger generations, the American kids born of immigrant parents, those two worlds are sometimes difficult to navigate, but they are a reality. And I think there's some, not only in music, but in poetry, some writers have really found a way of connecting to that and expressing that. And I was very impressed by this poem by Nisei poet Jay Yamazawa.
What's Nisei, Elizabeth?
Nisei means first-generation American born of Japanese parents. And in his poem, which he calls The Bridge, he explores his relationship with his father. It's quite strong, quite beautiful.
But really, my dad's a quiet man, and he appreciates the silence. And whenever I speak to him in English, he always returns the foreign favor. See, for him, speaking Japanese is like a walk in the park. I imagine speaking English is like climbing a barbed wire fence. See, my father's accent is bumpy, like the conversation between airplane tires and American concrete that welcomed his arrival to the United States. His pronunciation has trouble landing. His tongue knows turbulence. You see, my father is a chef, He'll add extra syllables to his sentences like seasoning, something that tastes better in his mouth. If I ever complain about hunger, he'll tell me to go get the cheeseburger at the Burger King. My father's accent can be an because my father's accent ain't smooth like my birth certificate. It's the rough edges around my family's grave. It's the crease that creates the wings on a paper crane. You see, my father's accent is like a hole in a Japanese internment camp fence. It's an escape route to his culture. His accent is thick, and his words stick together like the vinegar rice on his working hands. He spent more time cooking for people than working on his speech because he knew standard English wasn't going to feed his children. The recipe is his way of talking to Americans. It's how people understand what his heart is trying to say. You see, the accent is the mark of an immigrant. It's a ruler with mile-long increments that measures the distance away from home. See, maybe Asians are known to be good at math because that's the only homework our parents could help us with. Or maybe I'm being defensive because I'm afraid that my rusty Japanese is a broken chain link that can't hold my lineage together. I am afraid of passing down my lack of language to my children, and their grandpa's accent will sound more foreigner than family. I am selfish, writing poems and poems and poems about Japan when my name is the only word I know how to write in Japanese.
Mm-hmm. I don't need a passport to walk on this earth.
You can hear more of the WHYY podcast, Common Space, at WHYY.org. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. At the helm this week, Al Banks and Adam Staniszewski. Sandra Clark is Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. John Mussoni is Assistant Vice President for News Operations. Our News Director is Eugene Son. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.